There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd. Today we broadcast from the Jiuquan, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations.
My name is Maya Ibbotson, and this week is our last episode of radio for the 2020 year. It's definitely been a roller coaster, especially with the pandemic, but we've finally made it there. Speaking of the pandemic, this week we are focused on mental health in the wake of this weird year. We've got an interview with the Care Culture, which is a mental health group based out of Queen's University. Then we're talking to a friend of the show and Amy's roommate, Amanda Chu, about the stigmatization against Asian people during the pandemic. That's our feature, and before that, we've got our usual music and headlines. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Irrational by Shailia. Now for our weekly headline roundup. According to the Montreal Gazette, quote, Health Canada has confirmed that it should be ready to approve another vaccine for COVID-19 before the end of December. Last week, Dr. Supriya Sharma, the chief medical advisor at Health Canada, said the emergency review of the Pfizer vaccine was the most advanced and that Canada should be ready to greenlight it when the U.S. does. That is expected to happen around December 10th. Today, a spokesman said other vaccines should also be approved. At the same time, they are given emergency authorization by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Moderna today applied for the U.S. approval, and the FDA will meet December 17th to consider it, a time frame Health Canada said Canada will also be on track to meet, unquote.
In February 2019, Alexandre Bissonnette, the man who murdered six people in a Quebec City mosque in 2017, was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole for 40 years. That ruling has since changed. Quebec's Court of Appeal has reduced that sentence to 25 years before a parole application on Thursday's decision. The court found a 2011 amendment to the criminal code that allowed life sentences to be served one after another rather than concurrently was unconstitutional. The three-judge panel wrote that while a decision to set parole eligibility at 100 or more years, quote, may give some people a sense of satisfaction, it is grossly disproportionate, unquote, because it exceeds the person's expected lifespan. Just to recap, Bissonnette opened fire during evening prayers at a mosque in 2017 when he was 27 years old. Six men were killed, five were additionally wounded. Ayman Derbali, who was shot seven times and left paralyzed from the waist down in the attack, described the reduced sentence as quote-unquote unjust to Global News. The panel of judges still defended their decision, saying the reduced sentence was not a judgment on the damage of Bissonnette's actions on January 29th, 2017, but rather on the constitutionality of the law.
That concludes our weekly headline roundup. Again, you're listening to CKUT at 90.3 FM in Montreal. Now it is time for our debrief on mental health in the face of the pandemic and the racist stereotypes that plague the East Asian community, featuring our interviews with Amanda Chu and Care Culture. Please note, we want to issue a content warning for discussing issues of mental health and anti-Asian racism. Please enjoy.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize consciousness
is affected? Before we start this segment, I want to issue a content warning. In this segment, we discuss matters of anti-Asian racism, systemic racism, specifically regarding housing insecurity, anxiety, and depression. So on this show, we have discussed at length the importance of social distancing and, when necessary, social isolation. Although limited social interaction is a necessary measure to take when it comes to slowing the spread of the virus, human interaction is also a vital part of our life in order to maintain well-being. With the new reality of the pandemic, the idea of normalcy in regards to relationships has shifted significantly. This has definitely taken a toll on a lot of individuals, especially those doing their best at social distancing.
So just taking into account, this is an opinion, CAMH conducted a series of national surveys to establish a research foundation in order to, quote, understand the mental health and substance use impacts of COVID-19 and to track changes as the pandemic unfolds. So here's the following interactive dashboard, which represents selected findings based on five online surveys conducted over the following intervals. May 8th to 12th, 2020, with 1,005 respondents. May 29th to June 1st, 2020, with 1,002 respondents. June 19th to the 23rd, 2020, with 1,005 respondents. July 10th to 14th, 2020, with 1,003 respondents. September 18th to the 22nd, 2020, with 1,003 respondents. All survey participants were English-speaking Canadians aged 18 and older, unquote. So this survey found that nearly one quarter of women, so that's 24.3%, indicated experiencing moderate to severe anxiety, significantly higher than the 17.9% found amongst men. The same gender gap was evident in reports of loneliness, which saw 23.3% for women and 17.3% for men. Overall, parents with children under 18 living in the home were more likely to report feeling depressed, so that's at 29.1%, than adults without children, 18.9%. There was also a significant increase amongst both men and women reporting fear about getting COVID-19, with one quarter, 25.8%, saying they were worried compared to 20.3% in the last survey conducted in the summer. Heavy episodic drinking also remained a concern, with 28.5% of men and 22.6% of women reported binge drinking. One in five adult Canadians reported seeking professional help for mental health concerns as a way of coping with the pandemic at least once during the week preceding the survey.
On top of isolation, stigmatization of certain BIPOC communities contributes to this toll of stress and anxiety. As we touched on last semester, just as COVID started to spread globally, anti-Asian rhetoric grew exponentially. Racist comments, criticism, and public attacks targeting East Asian populations and their businesses across the world placed another strain on Asian people during this pandemic. My roommate, veteran of the show, and a McGill Daily writer, Amanda Chu, is joining us on the show today to discuss her experiences with anti-Asian racism in relation to the pandemic. Amanda is a U2 GSFS major at McGill. Her studies focus on Western colonization from the East Asian feminist perspective and the impact of anti-Asian racism in relation to social movements as well as media. Now, you'll hear from her. Brought to you live. All right, we're here with Amanda Chu. As I mentioned earlier, she is a U2 student at McGill studying and majoring in GSFS. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously on the show, we're discussing the stigmatization of anti-East Asian rhetoric that has stemmed from the pandemic. Obviously, anti-East Asian and anti-Asian racism in general has existed for a long time in Canada, but specifically regarding the pandemic, there's definitely been this sort of discourse out there that essentially blames East Asian people for the pandemic. And so I'm wondering, as a Chinese woman, how have you felt this newfound stigmatization in relation to the pandemic furthering your own anxieties and fears regarding the pandemic and lockdown and quarantine?
I think in order to address the racism that is prevalent in Canada, specifically due to COVID-19 and ideas surrounding the fact that the virus did originate in Wuhan, it's important to also acknowledge the fact that a lot of people, whether they be of Chinese descent or not, if they are visibly East Asian or kind of identified as such by those that are, you know, trying to be racist or that kind of thing, anyone can really be subjected to that racism as long as they are perceived in the public eye or in whichever environment that they are in as a product of China or East Asia in general. There's a lot of ignorance surrounding that. And I find that in growing up in Canada and having my own individual experiences involving racist remarks and that kind of thing, I've been the victim of racist remarks that are specific to Chinese people, but also to Japanese people and Korean people, to which I cannot even identify with because those aren't my racial backgrounds. So I think East Asian people, or the visibility of East Asian people as a whole, are what is suffering right now, especially with the prevalence of coronavirus and all of that. I think that Chinese people are definitely being blamed and stigmatized as carriers or encouragers of the disease, which is obviously not true. I've myself have been told to go back to Wuhan, or told that Chinatown in Montreal should be a place where people exercise caution in case they somehow contract the coronavirus, because that environment is inherently Chinese. And I think that adds definitely a added level of anxiety surrounding coronavirus, because Chinese people and East Asian people as a whole not only have to worry about the virus itself and the implications of said virus, for example, loneliness or, you know, job instability, that kind of thing, but we also have to worry about our everyday interactions with the public sphere, going out, walking in the park. If you're socially distanced from people, you know, not wearing a mask in a park in a large open space is generally okay. But when you're an Asian person or an East Asian person, there's always an anxiety that comes with anything that you do kind of in this post COVID-19 climate, where we could be attacked for the most minuscule of actions based solely on the fact that a lot of people believe that we are carriers of the virus, which is obviously a racist belief.
And I definitely think with this, again, anti-East Asian discourse that has, you know, come out of the pandemic, there's another strain of dark humor, specifically white boy dark humor, that is not funny. And I definitely, you know, been around times where, you know, someone has subjected you to a joke such as that, like go back to Wuhan or don't go to Chinatown. And I'm just wondering, what would you say to people that attempt at dark humor at the expense of East Asian people, and like especially regarding COVID?
I think humor where the punchline is someone's race as a whole needs to be reexamined in our society. I think growing up, and especially now, obviously I have experienced, unfortunately, very explicit statements and acts of racism towards me and my racial group. And even if it's played off as a joke, or it's supposed to be funny, not supposed to be too serious, if it's playing into stereotypes, if the punchline at the end of the day is something to do with the fact that I'm Chinese or racial inferiority, the thing is that even if it's presented as a joke, it's still deeply offensive. And I think a lot of people also don't realize that in making a joke like that in any sort of social environment, whether you're in a group of small people, a group of big people, obviously right now with COVID, it would be a small group of people. You're not only just making that joke and running the very high possibility that you're offending that individual, but you're also performing this alienation of that individual in the public environment that you're in, which kind of identifies that person loud and clear in the room as, hey, everyone, look at this person. Let's remember, let's remind them that they are a racialized person. And because of this, we cannot let them sit here and be a part of this social environment without firstly like acknowledging the fact that they're here and that this is their racial identity. Because a lot of the time, if people don't do that, they feel some sort of discomfort or feeling of entitlement where they're like, I need to remind this person that this is their status. This is what's up with them. This is where they belong. And I'm going to put them in their place by making this joke. And in making racist jokes, the thing that is the most unsettling with me is that if you're making racist jokes, I'm sure I can guarantee you that the person of color that is on the receiving end of that joke, this is not the first joke that they've heard. Quite frankly, your joke is probably unoriginal and they've probably heard it before because there isn't much nuance with racial stereotypes. But in doing that, you have to put yourself in that person's shoes and think, well, what if every day someone came up to me and made a joke about my race or my weight? Or this pimple on my face, right? At a certain point, you'd think to yourself, oh, there must be something wrong. There must be something inherently wrong about this feature about me or this part of my identity, because everyone feels the need to bring it up and use it as a site of discourse. It's not something that can, exist in a social environment and be passive. People need to be actively singling you out, actively ensuring that everyone in the room or everyone in the environment knows you are inferior. I can make this joke at your expense because you're part of this racial group.
So another systemic barrier that contributes to the, further feelings of isolation, stress, and anxiety that are rampant during this pandemic is housing insecurity. Housing insecurity is something that is normalized, weirdly enough, in big cities, and it's not something that governments really take a great effort to approach, comment on, and ultimately fix. According to the Center of American Progress, quote, there has been a long history of housing insecurity for people of color in the United States due to racially targeted policies and widespread discrimination, particularly within rental housing market. These policies and practices continue to keep people of color in poverty. In 2019, before the coronavirus pandemic hit, an estimated 34 million individuals were living in poverty in the United States, with Black and Latinx people experiencing higher rates of poverty than whites. Native American, Black, and Latinx renters were also more likely to be extremely low income. During the coronavirus pandemic, disparities by race have persisted. Renters of color report having less confidence in their ability to pay rent and experience greater difficulties staying current on rent compared with their white counterparts. It is clear that the coronavirus pandemic is affecting renters of color differently, exacerbating past inequality and leading to the path of a future worsening inequality, unquote. So we wanted to touch on housing insecurity because, as I mentioned earlier, it is a persistent reality, especially in big cities, that is, more pushed to the back burner and less brought to the forefront and discussed, because with the reality of the newfound economic situation we're in and the closure of certain industries, such as the service industries. A lot of people are facing eviction or housing insecurity or struggling to find places to rent and struggling to find consistent income. And of course, we were able to receive CERB during the summer, but the government has not really since then come up with a newfound plan with the reintroduction to lockdown once again. So now, Maya, what do you think?
Well, I think that also we've talked about, especially in Montreal, just kind of housing insecurity in general. We've definitely done a few segments last semester about gentrification and how that can impact especially communities of color. I believe we did a special on Park X and housing insecurity there. So we also touched on how in the summer in Montreal, eviction cases were placed on hold until the initial lockdown was lifted. That was something good that the government did. However, the eviction cases are still being processed despite the economic status of the country and the economic status of Montreal, as well as the closure of certain industries such as the service industry. I feel like that's also something we need to talk about in regards to rent. It's been noted that the Legault government really isn't doing much to keep the entertainment industry, the service industry alive in general, especially considering the fact that we've been in and out of lockdown. A lot of people don't know what to do or when to look forward to reopening their businesses. Therefore, it's kept a lot of people in taboo. And I think that that's something that needs to be addressed by governments, especially the Quebecois government, because a lot of people, especially as Montreal is such a service and restaurant oriented place, a lot more needs to be done to address this.
And just going off that, I think we also discussed just the rise in housing prices, especially amongst renters last year as well. And I think it's a consistent issue that, you know, we often see with big cities as they grow to be bigger and more popular. So does the, you know, housing competition, the prices. And I think that what we really need is rent control in order to better equip renters in general, but also that when we do have, you know, worldwide disasters such as a pandemic, we are already better prepared because pandemics happen all the time. And not all the time, it's a bit of a dramatic statement, but there have been many pandemics in the history of, you know, humanity. And I think that we need to start adjusting to that and acknowledging that and creating services and programs and policies that prepare people for the worst so that when there is a pandemic, you know, rent is controlled, people are not going to be evicted, and that there are government services to make up for the fact that some people have just lost their jobs or they can't work for the time being until the government decides that it's safe to reopen certain industries, certain businesses. So now that we've talked about, you know, the barriers of the systemic barriers that a lot of people are facing on that contribute to their well-being and their overall mental health, I want to talk about something that the McGill community and students alike are facing with the pandemic and all of its resulting issues. There is another barrier for young people, and that being online school. According to CTV, quote, post-secondary students at Canadian universities are largely studying in isolation this fall as COVID-19 restrictions stay in place for the new semester. Social isolation or social distancing that is tremendously challenging for people in this age range, said Nancy Heath, a McGill University professor of educational and counseling psychology. Heath explained that young people in university are in a developmental stage of their lives when they feel a strong drive to connect with others. That makes coping with public health restrictions on gatherings tougher for the demographic than for others, she said. That was reflected in the results of a study co-authored by Heath that was published in the Canadian Psychology last month. It surveyed 800 University of Toronto students about their mental health in May 2019 and then again in May 2020 after COVID set in, participants who had no history of mental health concerns reported greater psychological distress during the pandemic than their peers' pre-existing conditions. Isolation was a driving factor behind increased depressive symptoms, stress, and anxiety, unquote. I do know about you, Maya. I mean, we talk, but I know that I've seen a lot of my friends and myself, people both with a history of mental health concerns and both without, experience a huge shift, a huge struggle in feeling like they're catching up, being productive, feeling like they have, you know, a sense of community. That's definitely something that has been lost in general in the process of online school. And especially this, you know, overwhelming consistency of being on your computer doing everything on your computer, having very limited physical, you know, interactions, face-to-face interactions. And I'm not just talking about like hanging out with your friends, also with profs, with other classmates. It's definitely, you know, exhausting.
I feel like I have 2 points on this subject matter, especially for young people, I think. The first thing, what you're saying, just like spending literally 10 hours a day on a screen is just so bad for you, like not only for your mental health, but for your physical well-being. Like you can't just sit at a desk for 10 hours a day. That's terrible for you. But also nonetheless, like I think whether it's online school or just the fact that we're basically completely digitized at this point. Like we go from doing our classes on Zoom to keeping us entertained on TikTok or Instagram. And everybody, as everybody knows, social media is not great for your mental health either. So just being kind of completely surrounded in like a digital sphere is not good for you at all. Also, what I was going to say is I feel like I've talked to a few of my friends about this. I do think that as statistics show, young people are the main driving reason for the spread of COVID. However, I think it's very interesting to take into account the different demographics of young people who are going about their daily lives and also kind of the weird societal pressure that's being put on them. Mm-hmm. I feel it's really important, obviously, to address the main demographic of the people spreading COVID because that's how you stop COVID, but also kind of a bit of like a condescending rhetoric from people who can afford to stay inside of their houses and can afford to take time off of work and can afford to sit back and relax for 6 months and just not really mind. There are some people obviously our age who are behaving recklessly, but also at the same time we have to consider how there are of course some young people who still need to go out and work. Well, obviously not with a lockdown, but like in general there are like certain economic barriers, as we talked about earlier, that do prevent some young people from like doing the most for coronavirus. And I feel like the kind of patronizing rhetoric that's being taken place over young people and how the kind of the brunt of the pandemic has been put on our shoulders can't be good for our mental health either.
I know we talked about, you know, the responsibility young people have in with socially distancing a couple episodes ago. And I think that was more of a comment of, you know, evidently reckless behavior, such as the beloved, but also the behated Fight Club. And I definitely agree with you in that, as we discussed in our episode a couple weeks ago, there is, you know, a prefrontal cortex immaturity. And so decision making is hindered. Yeah, getting all psych 101. Yeah, I took that course in first year. But I definitely think it's something that it is a lot of pressure and it is a lot to expect young people who are already adjusting to this extremely isolating and strange online forum to also, you know, not hang out with people. Obviously, you know, you have to be careful. You have to be considerate while you do socially interact. You have to be safe. But I do understand that there's so much going on. There's so much that is changing. And I think that one thing that was mentioned in an interview with a student who chose to remain anonymous, McGill does have to do a better job at holding themselves accountable for their student population, whether that be, you know, the student population acting recklessly or just caring for their student population. So that takes us to an article that was recently published in the McGill Daily. It was written by Angelina Mazza and Kay Ellis, both editors of the McGill Daily and really cool people, titled "It Shouldn't Be This Hard to Be Accommodated. Students Discuss Barriers to Accessing McGill's Office for Students with Disabilities." So the Office for Students with Disabilities, also referred to as the OSD, is sort of, you know, I wouldn't say well known, but definitely known for being quite an inaccessible service and not always the most productive. And in this article, both editors do a great job in interviewing and explaining how the OSD often makes it more difficult for students with learning disabilities to access their, I forget the word now, but it's their, not requirements, but things that they are given by
through diagnoses that allows them, such as like extra time or noise canceling headphones or whatever it be, to help them take their exams better and help them study better. But at the end of the article, they kind of move on to the discussion of online school and what that means for students with learning disabilities, students in general. So to quote the article, Jonathan Stern, a professor in communication studies, highlighted the challenge that McGill community is facing in adjusting accessibility measures to remote learning. Quote, moving online means we are figuring out a lot of things again. Students are relearning to be students, profs are relearning to be teachers, and whatever accommodation schemes we had for classroom settings may not be the right ones for online learning. Professor Stern also stressed the importance of accessibility on an institutional level, stating that, quote, one thing the university could do better is educate people about disability. There is still a lot of ignorance and stigma in our community. Another faculty member, who asked to remain anonymous, echoed this idea while indicating the larger issue at hand. Quote, it's not the OSD's role to teach professors about universal design for instruction. The OSD does not have the human and financial resources to assume that duty. The university should undertake the social responsibility of educating everyone on ableism and how to put an end to it. There are ableist persons everywhere. We must fight ableism in academia. That is the challenge, unquote. So in that article, I think they did a really good job of explaining that the already, you know, institutional structure of McGill is extremely ableist. But now with this online forum, we're essentially expecting students to give up any sense of a personal life and just spend all your time on my courses, readings, weird, awkward lectures, rewatching those like 7 hour long lectures of just your prof's little tiny face screen. And that's somehow supposed to be like, you know, stimulating enough to actually do some learning.
Yeah. I think, when I think of OSD specifically, what I recall for those I know who utilize the service, it's mainly for test taking. So as you were saying earlier, Amy, just people who take extra time right at OSD or need noise canceling headphones, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of a weird thing where it's like, I feel like test taking for my courses especially have become a lot more lax with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. 'Cause obviously you can take it at home. I know most of them are given like 3 full days to write like your midterms or your finals. But also, that being said, maybe some people would be like, oh, well, that's basically like providing like exceptions via OSD. But no, it's not really, because also just the general structure of university now is making it hard for everybody to learn. So you have to take into account like not just testing, but the means to actually, as I was saying earlier, sit down for 10 hours a day and try and engage yourself in your material. From what I understand from my, namely limited, but some research, is that there's not much being done about the pandemic, of course, at McGill, but also in OSD. So that's something that we definitely need to work on.
Speaking of all that jazz, recently there has been a UBC cheating scandal where 100 students are currently facing expulsion because of a math exam where the prof essentially accused a large number of students of cheating on this exam. According to the CBC, they were using the US-based Respondus, which is currently giving schools a free 2-month trial of its 2 programs aimed at detecting and deferring cheating. To quote the article, the first program, called Lockdown, requires students to install a program on their computer, which then severely restricts what else they can do during an online test, such as opening another browser or chatting with classmates. Fourth-year University of Ottawa student Oliver Benning got word of the school's plan, because he goes to U Ottawa and they're planning on getting the program as well, to start using the Respondus products after fellow students posted concerns about it on a Reddit thread. To quote Oliver, I'm not saying the university shouldn't have any kind of academic integrity measures for student assessments. He said, I just feel like it needs to be in the middle ground. This is just way too extreme. So, obviously, with this whole test-taking fear that universities have of cheating, because there's, you know, you're not taking it in an exam room with a proctor, there is more freedom for, I suppose, cheating, but these programs that are meant to prevent cheating and detect cheating are not only an extreme invasion of privacy, but have now been found to also have an extremely racist algorithm.
I was on LinkedIn like a month ago, and I saw somebody post about their stance on this matter, and they were like, I refuse to take all of my midterms because they're using a proctor service. I was like, oh, sounds like somebody didn't study for their midterms. But honestly, it's like kind of facts. Like, yeah. I think that I wouldn't go as far as being like, I'm deferring all my midterms, but I'd be definitely sus if McGill put in a proctor service. Obviously, being white passing, I would benefit from the non-racist or the racist bits of it. But I think that in general, to huge violation of privacy. Nobody should ask you to install proctor software on your computer. So here's a quote from an article. Shea Swager is a, quote, university librarian and has seen the impacts of these systems up close. Their own employer, the University of Colorado Denver, has a contract with Proctorio, which I assume is another software. In her article, software that monitors students during tests perpetuates inequality and violates their privacy. She notes that, quote, it's become clear to me that algorithmic proctoring is a modern surveillance technology that reinforces white supremacy, sexism, ableism, and transphobia. The use of these tools is an invasion of students' privacy and often a civil rights violation. If you're a student taking an algorithmically proctored test, here's how it works. When you begin, the software starts recording your computer's camera, audio, and the websites you visit. It measures your body and watches you for the duration of the exam, tracking your movements to identify what it considers cheating behaviors. If you do anything that the software deems suspicious, it will alert your professor to view the recording and provide them a color-coded probability of your academic misconduct. Depending on which company made the software, it will use some combination of machine learning, AI, and biometrics, including facial recognition, facial detection, or eye tracking, to do all of this. The problem is that facial recognition and detection have been proven to be sexist, racist, and transphobic over and over and over again. In general, technology is a pattern of reinforcing structural oppression like racism and sexism. Now, these same biases are showing up in test proctoring software that disproportionately hurts marginalized students, unquote. So, first thing I thought when I heard this was like, yeah, no kidding. Because I remember I took a social psychology course, and they discussed how a lot of the technology is based on data from things such as the implicit bias test, which is a test that's done by the Harvard Psychology Lab, where people conduct basically implicit bias based on their, like, I guess, racial preferences is how they put it. And a lot of computer software right now is structured on people's biases. And a lot of these biases happen to be racist. So it would seem evident to me that if you're taking just data in general from computer programs as such, then they're going to be based on people's already preconceived biases because they're programmed by people, right?
Going off of that, it's just upsetting, I guess, to see that with the already overwhelming pressures that students are facing, adapting and succeeding with online school or attempting to succeed, you now have this new threat of an invasive proctor exam technology that also relies on racist algorithms to detect your cheating. And the other night, the reason why I thought to feature this on the show is because my friend was telling me about it, and she was saying how it will, suspicious behaviors can literally be defined as coughing or mouthing the question out loud if you're trying to read something and you're moving your mouth while reading it. And also the fact that it can monitor the websites that you visited. Not only is that super, super invasive.
1984.
Yeah, not only super, like, Orwellian, but also kind of awkward. Like, what if you're just, like, searching embarrassing things? Like, I don't know, cat Christmas sweaters. Oh, my God, could you imagine? But I just think that this just adds to the problem of universities not being accountable, not really, really, really caring for their students, possibly being hedge funds for research, but that's just my no-nuance November. And with all that said, it's just another barrier that students now have to worry about and face more pressures off, because being stuck on your computer and trying so hard to keep up during a pandemic is stressful enough, and now you have to fear that if you by accidentally cough in your exam, you can get expelled, you can be accused of cheating. So that is just a newfound pressure that I not only found to be super necessary to discuss because it is now a threat that all Canadian universities face, but it's something that I really think is extremely messed up.
To combat the isolation many students experience in this time, we spoke to a group of Queen's University students who created an online platform for people to share and listen to the experiences of mental health, garnering a sense of community. This project is known as Care Culture and was created by Alex LaBeouf, Carolyn Panic, JJ McWam, and Noah Marley. We will now hear what they have to say.
So, firstly, would you guys mind giving us an overview of what the Care Culture is and how you guys started it and why you started it?
Yeah, for sure. I can start, and then if anyone wants to add anything, they can. But basically, it started for our digital marketing course, like that we were given the assignment to start a blog about something that we're passionate about and something that we enjoy and really like. Alex and I are on a separate executive called like the Queen's Commerce Mental Health Association. And so like we kind of wanted to do something in the realm of mental health just because we really enjoyed, like we've enjoyed our time that we've spent on that club. So we wanted to do something around that. And then so as a team, the four of us kind of just collectively decided doing something around self-care for girls was something that we could all relate to and something that we all thought was something that we would like to do and see where it would go. And so basically, yeah, that's how it started. And it's something that's important to us. And especially during COVID times, we just wanted to remind people to take little moments for themselves throughout the week to take a break from like online work or online school.
And just to add in, I think kind of like our fundamental vision of like what we wanted to create it as is like making kind of an online platform as like a safe space to create like healthy and important dialogue surrounding both like mental health issues and just mental health awareness and general well-being and self-care for like young women. And it doesn't have to be particular university, just like any young women. And we decided to like target women as kind of our initial little like segment, I guess, just because it was a group that we could easily relate to. And it was like something that we could create content easily without having to do a ton of like market research or anything. And just to be able to like, it was something that we personally felt we wanted to see created and something like a platform on the internet regarding that. So yeah.
So your primary focus is offering an accessible space for students to share their experiences with mental health and resources as well. So I'm wondering, because at McGill, this is definitely a noticeable thing, it's popular amongst like student rhetoric, if the academic university environment at Queen's stigmatizes mental health.
Yeah, so I can take that. I would say that Queen's has definitely made some improvements and that it's easier to find resources now than it was. And people are talking about mental health a lot more because of new organizations like this and also like QCMHA, which Carol mentioned. But even with that, there definitely is still some stigma. So like there, especially in the commerce program, but then in general, there's a lot of pressure like around exams, classes, joining different clubs, conferences, getting jobs, things like that. And then also just kind of glorifying exam stress and study stress as well. Like there's just this kind of stigma that everyone should study super hard and always be working and sleep isn't important and working out or seeing your friends and all that doesn't matter as long as you're studying really hard. And that's just something that we want to change, which is kind of also why we focused on self-care.
Yeah, so I think like also just to add to that, when we were talking about this, I think one thing like we were really thinking about is like obviously what's available has I think definitely improved and progressed from like when we were in first year. But I also think like it's important to like notice that there's definitely a lot of room for improvement and just like people's mindsets regarding like taking care of yourself and your well-being as a student, whether it's like the academic institution itself or like the social atmosphere around mental health as well. So I think like obviously there are resources for students if you need like counseling and such, but do you guys remember what it's called, like an academic like consideration or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, so like obviously there are things in place to help out students in terms of like the university helping out, but there's definitely I think we all agree that there's a lot more room for like wider spread access to these kind of supports.
Yeah, and just going off of that also, like there is a lot of like there is like things that are available to us, but it's still hard to like get appointments and stuff like that. So we just want to like bring more focus to that.
So going back to care culture, why do you think that social media is the best platform for this project? Social media can definitely be a uniting medium, but it also can be an isolating one. So how do you guys ensure that your content reaches your audience in an effective way?
So for this one, I think what you're talking about is like the first part of your question, kind of about why we chose social media. And I think like that kind of ties into like the fundamental reason or like how this project was started. So we have social media and like a blog as our main platform just because of like the nature that it was created, which was through like a digital marketing class. So choosing social media as like our primary medium is definitely fueled by kind of where the project started from and originated from, because we did need to include socials and creating like a blog as part of the entire platform. So that's where that stems from. And then in terms of kind of creating like inclusive content, I'll just speak to one thing and then you guys can pipe in. But I think one thing that we've really been trying to do is reaching out into our community to try to get content from other people rather than just creating this content ourselves, because obviously we don't have like a huge framework of experiences and knowledge among the four of us. Like it is quite limiting. So what we've been doing is trying to reach out to people that we know or friends of friends and other resources through different clubs at Queen's to either expand like the Candid Culture series, which is people talking about their personal stories and experiences with mental health, or just like asking people if they're interested in writing blog posts and like for general feedback. So I think that's one way we're trying to create more inclusive content. And then if you guys want to touch on, go ahead.
The only thing that I would add as well is that, especially from a COVID standpoint, like using social media is just a great way to connect with people virtually. And like we have been able to, reach out to people and like follow people who we might not otherwise like get to have face-to-face conversations with or something like that. And like on our website, we've got, or on our blog at the bottom of the page, there's a comment box where you can leave like tips about how we could like improve our social media or like suggestions for tips on self-care or anything like that. Like we really want people to give us insight because like we've said, this was started for a course. Like this really came to be in the span of like 6 weeks, but from the time we were given the assignment until now. And like before this, like all of us had never done anything like this. So honestly, like any advice that we can get from people, we really appreciate. And we've gotten some like from Amy helping us out on how we can make a more inclusive environment. So we just really appreciate stuff like that. And I think that's also why we chose social media and why we keep using it.
Mm-hmm. And just to add on to that, it's just as Alex and Carol mentioned, because of the COVID environment, but also all the other current kind of associations around mental health are all about events and more clinical and having psychologists and things like that. And we wanted ours to just be more relatable and to reach more people. So having it set up like that is better for just reaching Calmer students or just looking for a very specific group, and it's more kind of academic. But this way, it's like an easy way to reach people and share our positivity and our posts and get them involved with our Candid Culture. And it doesn't really require any time commitment, and we can reach just like a much greater depth of kind of a target market as well.
Right. So you guys mentioned obviously your website, social media, your specific segments and stuff, but what are some of the ways that self-care culture can uplift people, like the kind of things that you're mentioning? And also part two of the question, what are ways in which self-care culture can overgeneralize mental health or further contribute to stigmatization, pros and cons?
Yeah, so I can start with this one. One thing we're doing to uplift people is just like positive quotes, posts on Instagram, social media, things like that. And then also our blogs, which have a lot of just tips and things like getting exercise during quarantine or combating study stress. But in no means are we meaning to overgeneralize things. Like obviously a couple of tips and a positive post isn't going to fix anything for someone who's having a serious challenge with any kind of mental illness or having a really bad mental health day. And by no means are we saying we're going to fix that and that this is the cure to anything or that we're experts in that area in any way. It's just more of a way of spreading positivity and just opening up the conversation and making it more normal to talk about, but also prioritizing self-care, not just thinking, okay, going out working, like there's other things to consider, and that's kind of our main goal.
Yeah, and like just going off of that, like we sort of like we haven't branded ourselves as like this sort of like helpline. Like that's why we have all these resources included, so that if someone is really struggling, that they have places they can go if they come across our blog. So we're just promoting like how to be the best version of yourself, doing like the little things that we find enjoyable, like how to get a proper sleep and how to combat your study stress and how to like see your friends and stay happy during quarantine and stuff like that.
I would also add that, sorry, Alex. I was also just gonna add like self-care, I think uplifts people because, you know, everyone like loves those little breaks in their week when they can be like, oh, I can like put away my work for the night. And like, whether it's like, oh, I get to watch like an episode of my favorite show or going to bed early, like people enjoy those moments. And I think when we write about it, like we're not trying to say like that is what's going to improve your mental health. The way we write about it is like, these things can like make you feel good. And I think that's why we really wanted to include our candid culture, where people can talk about their mental health experiences, people who have suffered through like serious mental health challenges. And those are the kinds of posts where people can look for more like how those people got out of those situations.
Yeah, and sorry, I'll just add something really brief, but I think just to kind of tie into what all of the what everyone said is like our ideal going into this care culture blog was that we wanted to include content that is inclusive all across the continuum of like, if you guys know what we're talking about of like the chart where it's like mental health on one end, mental illness on the other, and then positive mental health and negative mental health. And I think our goal, and obviously since it's only been about 6 weeks, like we haven't hit every single point on this continuum, but like our big goal is to have content that touches on all the different aspects of the continuum, whether you have struggled with a mental illness or not, whether you have poor mental health or positive mental health, and just to be able to relate to people going through all different types of things and of all different walks of life. And I think that's kind of like a long-term focus, obviously, because it is hard to like pump out content every week and we're doing our best, but I think that's kind of like the holistic vision, I guess, for our blog. And that's how we're kind of trying to combat that overgeneralization that like doing a face mask is going to cure your whatever mental health challenge you're going through, because obviously it's not. And it's just like trying to create a big amount of content to appeal to all those different types of situations that people are dealing with. So yeah.
Now that this is our last episode of the semester and we hate to leave you guys without any amazing and interesting unfit to print content for the winter break, we do want to emphasize the importance of taking time for yourself over this break to recharge from the very, very stressful and strange semester this has been. Granted, we don't know yet if McGill will decide to extend the winter break. I hope they do. There are some small ways that you can cope in everyday life, and some of them are recommended by CAMH, some of them are other resources that we found, some of them just come from us. So we're going to read them now. We hope that, you know, you find them helpful. These are not like psychology tips by any means, and we are not, you know, warning, we're not claiming to be experts by any means, but we just thought that, you know, in times of panic of our own, we definitely look to these tips and tricks to help us gain some control over our life. And we hope that they can be helpful for you guys as well. Although we have to sit by and wait when it comes to matters of the pandemic, we can control our day-to-day lives. Don't worry, this isn't a preachy stay fat and drink green juices rant. But structure can provide some sense of control in these unusual times. So whether it be cooking for yourself, making time in the day for yourself, preferably offline, it's important to take moments where you are feeding yourself, caring for yourself. You're not just sitting
at your desk in the dark, fueled by coffee and Juul pods. So, you know, be kind to yourself once again.
Your body's a temple, remember it. Okay, so in terms of structuring, also consider your sleep schedule as well. Oh my goodness, I am such a big proponent of this. I have not had like a proper sleep since I was in grade 8. Online school paired with staying inside most of the time. My sleep schedule inevitably varies a lot, varies more than usual. I find myself waking up at 11 a.m. or sometimes, especially with daylight savings, actually, I get tired at like 7 p.m. and then wake up at like 6 a.m. and I'm like, but I'm awake for what though? Anyways, life happens and you can't always catch 8 hours as recommended within a reasonable time frame. So just try giving yourself a couple of days out of the week where you can get to bed earlier. Or my favorite tip, if you're having trouble falling asleep, just get like the most boring book that you have and read it, and it'll put you to bed right away.
With that said, not all self-care techniques are as glamorous as a bubble bath and face mask. At times, getting out of bed or eating a balanced meal can be a seriously difficult task. A friend of the show and editor at the McGill Daily, Kate Ellis, who I often mention on the show, provided a quote-unquote less cute self-care thread via their personal Twitter. I found this thread to be refreshingly honest and super helpful. I'm now going to read the thread out loud for y'all, and thank you so much, Kate, for the thread, of course. First and foremost, quote, there are YouTube tutorials for everything. I've searched things like how to use a can opener, how to dice an onion, and a bunch of other things. Super beats the shame of asking someone else and helps your brain when it's blanking.
Keep easy, non-perishable snacks. I have crackers on your bedside table for when you're having trouble getting out of bed so you can have something to eat.
My favorite depression meals, plain rice or noodles, frozen dumplings, microwave burritos, canned soups. These are just, you know, things that you can eat that are super quick when you don't have the energy to make something super fancy that will take like 3 hours.
To-do list for everything. I put things like eating, showering, and making appointments on my to-do lists when I'm having trouble.
Buy pajamas that look like clothes. If you can't change out of your PJs, having something that you can wear in public is good.
Cool, and I discovered today. You can schedule orders in advance on Uber Eats. If you think that you're going to get busy and forget to make dinner or will be too tired to make coffee in the morning, schedule an order in advance.
The app Timo, T-I-I-M-O, has changed my life. There's a 2-week free trial, and it's a great way to try out routines and use calendar and checklist all in one.
If you have sensory issues, like me, finding clothes that you really find comfortable and buying them in every color/pattern is a great way to have a comfortable wardrobe. You can use accessories and such to change up your outfits.
Online school hack. If Monday lectures are pre-recorded, sometimes I'll watch them on Sunday to free up a little bit of time of my week, especially good if you're struggling with the reading because then you have time on Monday to look at it after hearing the prof explain. Unquote. So that was Kate's thread, and it was really helpful and definitely does a good job of providing useful tips that don't have a strange glamour and je ne sais quoi about them.
All right, so that basically concludes our segment, but as per usual, we're going to do our resource list / conclusion. The first things first, we have The Care Culture from, this is obviously the organization featuring the lovely ladies we had on our show. In our resource list, we have their Instagram, but they have a website as well, but that is in their Instagram bio. Briefly, Care Culture's Instagram, which provides wellness tips and personal stories of stress management and mental health challenges, is featured here.
Next up is an article written by Li Zhao titled How the Coronavirus is Surfacing America's Deep-Seated Anti-Asian Biases. This is a Vox article detailing the implications of coronavirus in America's historical anti-Asian racism. This is something that we discussed earlier on in the show, and we thought that if you want to do some more reading about it, this would be a great source to do so.
The next one we have is the CAMH Mental Health and the COVID-19 Pandemic Resource, just a website. So CAMH, again, is the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. It's based in Toronto, and this is their guide to pandemic mental wellness. So it includes discussion forums, surveys, access to resources and psychiatric help, coping strategies, and more. It's really great.
Also the CAMH website is super, I like the way it's formatted because it has little tips in every sort of realm of anxiety and stress.
It's clear too. It's very clear.
Yes. Last but not least, we have Software That Monitors Students During Tests Perpetuates Inequality and Violates Their Privacy by Shay Swager. I'm not quite sure if that was pronounced correctly, but bear with me.
that was the article that we quoted a couple moments ago about, it's an MIT Technology Review. It details the racist implications of proctor applications frequently used at universities with the new pandemic. So obviously check that out. And that's all. That's all for today, folks.
And that's all, folks. We hope that you enjoyed our segment. We hope that you enjoyed our show this year. Definitely been weird, for sure. 2020 has been a weird one.
It's been a learning experience.
Yeah, but hopefully we ended on a good note, on a feel-good note, and we'll see you back on the show.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT 90.3 FM. Thanks again for listening to our little segment. We hope everyone found it informative. And a huge thank you to Amanda and the girls from the Care Culture for taking the time out of their days to speak with us. Unfortunately, we cannot play as many songs as we wish to on today's episode because our feature was especially long, but we will link the resources mentioned in our show to our Twitter and our Instagram. Just search for Unfit to Print. We hope everybody enjoyed our episodes this year. And if you have any feedback or suggestions, just shoot us a DM on Twitter or Instagram. Thank you again to our lovely listeners for tuning in. We'll see you in the new year.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.